This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll join Betsy Nash, the grape nut, as she learns about the wine grape harvest.
I have to admit that when we were coming out of the barrel room, I did eat a grape or two.
Well, I'm going to have to charge you for that.
Of course you were.
Also, Congresswoman Maxine Waters talks about the importance of groups like the NAACP.
I don't often have an opportunity to talk with your area, and the NAACP is what keeps me connected with communities outside of my district in very special ways.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, October 11th, 2021. I'm Carol Tangeman. Beyond the Furrows is our 12-part series covering farm workers on the Central Coast, their lives, their problems, and their dreams. KCBX's Francisco Martinez has explored the world of farm workers over the course of 12 episodes, from wage theft and pesticide exposure to the more personal issues of loneliness and isolation. In the last of our farm worker profiles and the last episode of Beyond the Furrows, you'll meet Amancio, a farm worker who wants to see positive change in his line of work.
Within the first few moments of talking to Amancio, who lives in Santa Maria, you'll notice he has an idea of what makes farm workers so important and what they do to complete their necessary work.
Porque si no trabaja un campesino, pues no pueden comer lo demás.
Amancio says all of us can't eat if farm workers don't work. He says farm workers do the toughest job people can see by waking up early, staying up late, working in the cold and rain. He says it's tough for him because a farm worker experiences everything. But the 40-year-old is tenacious, and that tenacity comes from his time in the fields, picking strawberries, a job he still does now. Amancio has been in Santa Maria for 20 years. Most of those years have been alone, away from his family in the Mexican state of Guerrero. His brother was in the U.S. for a bit, but now Amancio is on his own again, and he stresses his need to find community here.
Solo de esa manera, pues, puede salir uno adelante.
Amancio says having a community is the only way to get ahead. He says if you're not involved with a lot of people, you won't get ahead. Amancio says community makes it possible to lift everyone up and to work toward fairer wages for himself and his fellow farm workers. The low wages Amancio faces affect him in ways beyond finding affordable and adequate housing or buying food for sustenance. It also affects how he lives his life, including his love life. Amancio says he wants to get married but can't because of how little he makes as a farm worker. He feels it's important in marriage to have and be an equal partner.
Hasta la palabra mismo dice.
To Amancio, partner focuses on the part between a couple. He says if one part is 50% and the other is 50%, then it adds to 100. He says that is the life of a couple. That mindset, Amancio says, is why he hasn't found someone to share his life with. He says one potential love interest went out the picture because she wouldn't put her fair share into the equation. But while love is something Amancio has thought a lot about, it's not the main thing he keeps coming back to in our conversation. It's doing what's right. He says it's most important to be your own person and unite with others, through respecting others and whomever. By doing that, Amancio says you're being a good citizen and person to everyone, even yourself. Amancio makes an effort to live by these words through his involvement with the Central Coast Alliance United for a Sustainable Economy, or CAUSE. That's an organization advocating for economic, social, and environmental justice for working class and immigrant communities. Amancio's community work with CAUSE includes reaching out to his fellow farm workers about issues that affect them, like pesticides and their rights as farm workers. He says many of his fellow workers greatly appreciate what he shares with them.
Necesitamos la unidad de unirnos, apoyarnos como familia, como hermano, no como...
Amancio says farm workers need unity through supporting everyone like family. He says a farm worker that's dirty from working should not be outcast because those farm workers are the ones who suffer, waking up early and bringing food to the table. It's that belief that drives Amancio in his community work. And his tenacity in that work and in the fields is reflective of many farm workers' experience here in the United States and along the Central Coast. They are working hard to get ahead. Stories like Amancio's and the other farm workers we've profiled over the last few weeks, Maria's, Reina's, Francis's, and countless others, are the brushstrokes that produce a portrait of the farm worker experience. Farm workers in this country and right here on the Central Coast, like the ones we've heard from, experience struggles day in and day out. As Amancio says, many farm workers suffer, but many also fight against suffering and for their rights. Matt Garcia, a professor at Dartmouth College whose academic work focuses on California's agricultural labor history, explains why that fight for farm worker rights is important in the greater American experience.
We present ourselves as a country that believes in the American dream, the ability to apply your labor, to work hard, and to get somewhere and to have success. So this is really just honoring what we say we're about as a society, number one. Number two is that our ability to feed our families and to feed ourselves is dependent on these workers. And so if they're unfairly treated, if they can't take care of their families, then we are not paying our due as consumers of the food that is produced in our fields in this country.
It's not just our country as a whole. It's our Central Coast. It's our home. It's our families right here that benefit from farm worker labor, with every meal we eat, every food item we buy. We share this home together with farm workers, and Garcia says the fight for farm worker rights is the fight for all workers' rights.
We can all be treated this way. We can all be regarded as disposable. So the question is, where do we draw that line? We should not draw the line at the people that are producing food. We should include them as people that have a right to a fair wage, a livable wage, and a healthy working environment.
To many, Cesar Chavez is considered the person who brought the fight for farm worker rights to the forefront of our society.
All my life, I have been driven by one dream, one goal, one vision: to overthrow a farm labor system in this nation that treats farm workers as if they were not important human beings.
Although Chavez is gone, the fight continues. And people right here on the Central Coast, both farm workers and non-farm workers, carry on Chavez's legacy. Safe working conditions, accessible health care, fair wages, equal rights. They're all issues that people fight for, and they also fight for community and family, not just in the fields, but beyond the furrows. For KCBX News, I'm Francisco Martinez.
The 12-part series Beyond the Furrows was made possible by a grant from the Sunflower Foundation. You can listen to the whole series. It's on our website, kcbx.org, under the Programs tab. It's harvest time for wineries all over the Central Coast, and Betsy Nash, who we call the Grape Nut, wanted to get a closer look. So she headed to Tally Vineyards.
Well, good morning, my little Grape Nuts. Did you know that the village of Oro Grande is dark and empty at 6 in the morning? But it's worth it to me because I get to drive out to Tally Vineyards and talk with Brian Tally, who's going to be telling us all about the harvest while they pick the grapes and what happens afterward. It's been interesting to me since, again, back at Cal Poly in the early 70s when my roommates and I were taking a Chicano studies class and we drove over to the Central Valley and spent a day picking grapes. Okay, we spent an hour or so picking grapes. It was hot. And reaching under this canopy of leaves with the knife and cutting off these heavy, after a while, clusters of grapes. It was hard work. And so I've had a heart for farm workers ever since. Thank you, Brian, for inviting me. I'll get up at 6 a.m. and see what you've got going on over at Tally Vineyards. As I get closer to Tally, still in the dark, yes, I can see bright floodlights off to my right in what I expect will be the vineyard we'll be visiting. I'm talking with Brian Tally from Tally Vineyards. And am I right? Are you third generation?
I am. I'm a third generation farmer and second generation wine grower.
We're going to go see Rosemary's Vineyard. That's your mom, right?
Yes, Rosemary is my mother, and she lives right in the heart of Rosemary's Vineyard, which is our most highly acclaimed vineyard.
Matter of fact, I just opened a 2014 Magnum. It was wonderful. You have an Oliver's Vineyard. Who is Oliver?
Oliver was my grandfather, and he was the one that started farming here back in 1948, really the founder of the company. You know, he was the one that signed off on my dad's idea to start planting wine grapes back in 1982.
When did you start harvesting? It seemed like it was early. Is getting earlier every year?
No, this has actually been a later season. We started.
That's what I said later. That's what I meant to say.
Okay. Yes, we started later this year, right at the very end of August. I'd have to look back in my notes to see our first day, but it's been going on for more than a month, and we're not even halfway done. As I talk to other sort of old timers in the industry, we talk about 2021 really being reminiscent of earlier years. We've had a lot of fog. It's been extremely cool.
Yes.
We have lowish yields, and I think that's potentially a combination for some really, really great wines in this vintage.
I had heard some vintners further up Edna Valley say that they had such horrible weather that they're probably not going to be harvesting for a while because the grapes just hadn't matured and they're having mildew problems and all. Did you run into any of that down here?
We are having some challenges. What we typically do here when we see things like mildew or botrytis, which is a mm-hmm. rot that grows on the grapes, mm-hmm. we've had to make several passes through parts of the vineyard to remove that fruit so that there's no chance that it ends up in a fermenter and in the wine that we're making.
You don't just have the Rosemary Vineyard. We're at the East Rincon Vineyard of Pinot.
Buenos dias.
Buenos dias.
Can you describe how the setting of this is different enough to make a different wine?
This is a block that was planted by my father back in 1984, and it is now the oldest block that we farm here at Tally Vineyards. What makes this really unique is the combination of this calcareous clay soil that we have here at the lower part of the vineyard. It's a little bit less clay content than we see in our West Rincon vineyard, and so this wine tends to have a little bit finer expression.
Define finer expression.
So East Rincon vineyard has a little bit higher acidity, and I would describe the tannin structure, again, as being a little bit more refined. I would describe some of the West Rincon Pinot Noirs to be maybe a little bit more rustic. The French would use the term sauvage or wild.
Wild.
Whereas this expression is more elegant and refined. And
okay.
So as we think about people in our lives, mm-hmm. we probably can think of someone who is sort of sauvage versus someone who is very elegant and refined.
Got it. Why do you harvest at night? My background in HR leads me to believe it's so people don't have to work in the heat. But it probably has something to do with the grapes.
Well, it's really both. It is more pleasant to work when it's dark, when it's cooler. There tends to be less bee activity, which is one of the banes of our existence is bees and yellow jackets. The other thing is it is better for wine quality because the grapes stay very cool, especially these Pinot Noir grapes. If you've noticed, they're black in color, mm-hmm. and so they absorb a lot of heat during the day. Oh. So to the extent to which we can harvest them at night, they stay cooler, come to the winery sooner, and then our production team also arrives very early in the morning so that they can get the processing done.
So like beer, it's cold filtered or whatever they say about beer. It's just, for some reason, it's better for the product.
It is better for the product. Since we're sorting those grapes, they just tend to flow through the system better when they're cooler and more turgid, as opposed to over the course of the day, as it warms up, they tend to soften up and just mm-hmm. get a little more mushy.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Brian, what time did the vineyard workers get here to start picking rosemary this morning?
So they arrived here at 1 o'clock this morning. We're coming up a little light over here, and that's a real theme of the 2021 harvest. Especially in Pinot Noir, we're down about 20% relative to our estimates.
That means fewer grapes on the vine or fewer you can use? Explain that.
So that means that there are fewer grapes on the vine. Often there's the correlation between less grapes and higher quality.
I've heard that, and is it because of the drought?
That's a good question. I've been farming for a long time, and it's often hard to figure out exactly why we end up with a smaller or larger crop than we project. Mm. You know, in this case, I just think that during the time of fruit set or pollination, the clusters didn't develop the way that they would in a more normal season. Consequently, they're a little bit smaller, and that's what accounts for our smaller yield this year.
All right. We were talking about maybe a lower yield this year, and you were describing how that means even better wine. But it is concerning, isn't it?
Yes, it is, because basically grapes are the single most important or most significant cost factor in fine wine. We're not making Budweiser, so we're not spending inordinate amounts of money on marketing. And so when we have less grapes, given the fact that we've got so many fixed costs, that just means that the cost of our product is going to be higher in 2021.
So it's a good thing it's going to be even better wine.
Well, yeah, that's certainly my hope. You know, we never really know exactly what we're going to get until after fermentation is complete, and we'll do our first assessment of the vintage right after the first of the year. You know, all the signs to me right now are that we should have some really exceptional quality this year. But again, I've learned after doing this for about 30 years that we never really know until the following spring what we think we're going to get.
For Issues and Ideas, this is Betsy Nash, the Grape Nut. I'm with Brian Talley at Talley Vineyards, and we're talking about harvesting. We've just come down from Rosemary's Vineyard, and we're going to find out what happens to the grapes next.
That's the sound of the sorting machine. And there are also people hand sorting.
That's right. We've got some of our interns here, which is really our key labor force for Crush here at Talley Vineyards. What they're doing is basically hand sorting the Pinot Noir grapes that we harvested this morning. Just really trying to get out any leaves as well as any obviously rotten grapes that might have made it through the harvest process.
I have to admit that when we were down coming out of the barrel room, I did eat a grape or two.
Well, I'm going to have to charge you for that.
Yeah, I'll just... Oh, God, of course you were. So sweet, so delicious, just the grape.
Well, Pinot Noir is, in my opinion, one of the very best wine grapes just to taste. And, you know, as a more general comment, the reason why wine is most successful when it's made from grapes, because let's face it, wine could be made from lots of other fruit, is that grapes have a very unique balance of both very high sugar as well as high acidity.
Mm-hmm.
And we put that balance together, and quite frankly, that's even accentuated here in this cool climate that we're farming in. That's what results in world-class wine.
We run into Eric Johnson just outside the barrel room. He's been the winemaker here at Talley Vineyards since 2010. And he's going to tell us what it is I'm smelling and looking at here.
Yeah, so this is some Rosemary's Pinot Noir. Yeah, it's the good stuff. We picked this about 2 weeks ago, and it has gone through fermentation, and it is time to press it. So we have it in the basket press now, and this is going to last about 2 hours or so. It's a very gentle pressing. And you can see right out here, it's this brilliant red color, kind of purpley red, actually, with some pink bubbles. And you mentioned the smells. It's just bursting with like raspberry and plums right now. It's kind of really cool to smell these things as they're being pressed.
I love it. It's much easier to identify the smells when it's like this rather than when it's just come straight out of the bottle.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. You know, I think we have another 30 minutes or so, and then we're going to put this to the barrel and kind of pack it in for winter, and then we'll, you know, do blends with this about 10 months or so.
Fabulous, thank you. I'm with Eric Johnson, the winemaker here at Talley Vineyards, and we're talking about what happens after the grapes come out of the field. And we were looking at the pressing of the Rosemary Pinot. Eric, you were saying that it's going to go into barrels. These are the barrels I'm looking at here, because I see both wooden barrels and I see metal barrels and some big, big stainless vats. Where is it going?
Exactly. Well, so right now it's going into a stainless tank. And then once it's completed, we will put it into wooden barrels. And then, it will age for... I mean, this will probably about 10 months before we start doing blendings, and overall it'll age about 14 months in barrel.
I can tell we're coming to the barrel room before we even turn the corner because of that great smell.
Oh, that's great. You know, I'm sort of immune to it now because I smell it every day, but we're going to walk in there and see what's in the barrel room.
Oh my gosh, this is great. Brian and I are in the barrel room where you have hundreds of barrels.
Yeah, we've got about 1,400 barrels in here, and this is where the majority of Talley Vineyards wines spends the majority of their lives before the wine is bottled.
Where are the Pinot Noir grapes while they're fermenting, then, if they're not in these barrels?
Well, we can step into our winery and look at fermentation, which is going on right now. They are in 4x4 fermenters where they typically spend about 2 weeks, 15 days. They're punched down by hand, which is a very, very classical technique that results in very, very gentle extraction of really the character and the color that resides in the skins. And what a lot of people don't understand is that Pinot Noir, like almost every other red grape variety, the juice is actually clear. And so all of the color is coming from the skins. And that's why we ferment virtually all red wines on the skins to extract that color.
Well, the skins also provide the tannin. Is that right?
That's true. Tannin, anthocyanin, and other compounds that play a very, very important role in both the character as well as the ageworthiness of red wines.
Brian, we're in the fermenting room.
Yeah, so this is the winery. This is full of fermenting Pinot Noir, and right now I'm punching some of it down. And this is a very gentle process by which we extract color and the character from the skins. So I'll start that punch down now.
I thought you said this was done by hand.
This is done by hand. Got a big stainless steel sort of plunger device that I'm punching through the skins that are all floating to the surface. And look at that beautiful crimson foamy wine that is coming to the top of the fermenter. And an important part of this process is just punching down what's called the cap so that it doesn't spoil. And during the height of fermentation, we'll practice these punch downs typically twice a day.
How many fermenting, what are these called?
These are fermenters, and in here right now we've got about 15.
So somebody's going to get in shape doing this twice a day. So it really is an art, and it takes practice and probably trial and error before you know how long to keep the skins on, or, you know, before you do that, and how long to ferment and all of that, right?
Well, it's interesting, the idea of trial and error, because we as wine growers and winemakers, we really only get once every year.
Yes.
Even though we do it over and over, we try to get it right every year.
Of course, of course. So we walk out and find these big, luscious bins, and I'm looking for Lucy and Ethel to be stomping on these. Is that too much to ask?
Yeah, we do a little bit of foot stomping here. We won't do any on this. This is Rosemary's Vineyard Block 10, and this is a section that's near and dear to my heart. This was actually the first section of vines that I was personally responsible for planting back in 1995. I'll always remember the day that I was laying out this vineyard with our vineyard manager at the time, and my dad walked out the back door of his house and looked at what we were doing and remarked that it looked like the vines were going to be too close together. My father had planted all of our original plantings on 12-foot rows, and I was going to plant these on 8-foot rows. And my father was concerned that we weren't going to be able to drive our D4 Caterpillar, which we used in tilling our vines in those days. I suggested that it was probably time for us to buy a new tractor. And my dad, to his credit, he accepted my decision. And moving forward, all of our more recent plantings have been on either 8 or even down to 6-foot plantings to really just get better utilization out of the land.
Wouldn't be a winery visit and learning all about harvesting and the whole process if I didn't get to taste some here at the end. So what are you opening, Brian?
So I am opening our signature Pinot Noir, which in this case is going to be our 2019 Estate Pinot Noir.
All right.
And this dates back to our inaugural vintage back in 1986. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and open this right now.
Music to my ears.
All right. Okay. And you can note this beautiful sort of garnet color. Pinot Noir of all red varieties tends to be the lightest in color, tends to be very soft and approachable compared to most red wines in its youth. And one thing to notice about Pinot Noir is just the beautiful fragrant aroma. Mm-hmm. There's just kind of a nice combination of almost like a bowl full of red fruit.
Maybe
a combination of raspberries and blackberries, along with some beautiful violet kinds of notes. And then just a really silky and velvety on the palate, a nice finish, which is really enhanced by relatively high acidity, which is a characteristic of this cool climate. And as far as food pairing with this wine, I just love this with some of the local salmon that we're getting right now. Cheers.
Cheers. Thanks, Brent.
All right. I'm not actually going to taste it. Well, I'll join you.
Well, that's the harvest in the vineyard, and the picking seems to be done much the same way as I did it 50 years ago, but these people know what they're doing, of course, and it's also done in the cool of the night, I am glad to see. So the sun is up as I drive home, and thanks to Brian Talley for an informative morning all about harvest. I look forward to talking with you next month as we learn something else about wine on the Central Coast. For Issues and Ideas, this is Betsy Nash, The Grape Nut, on KCBX Public Radio.
And now, the nonprofit story.
This is Dr. Consuelo Mukes, and this is a special edition on Issues and Ideas with Congresswoman Maxine Waters. Maxine Waters is the U.S. representative for California's 43rd Congressional District and is known as one of the most powerful women in American politics today. She has made history as the first woman and the first African-American chair of the House Financial Services Committee, and is the most senior of the 12 black women in Congress. Congresswoman Maxine Waters is the keynote speaker for the NAACP San Luis Obispo County Freedom Fund Gala, Committed to Social Justice, on Saturday, October 16th. Congresswoman Waters, thank you for joining us today on this interview. In your time schedule, which I know is always tight, you are going to be speaking here in San Luis Obispo County at the Freedom Fund Gala for the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP. I would just like to ask you if you would just share a little bit with us about your relationship with the NAACP.
Oh, thank you very much for inviting me. I was very pleased to get the invitation because I don't often have an opportunity to talk with your area about issues like the NAACP. And the NAACP is what keeps me connected with communities outside of my district in very special ways. And so I am a lifelong member, and of course, I honor the work of the NAACP and honor the history and understand the work that has been done of fighting for justice, equality, and freedom that was done, and all of the court actions that have been taken, you know, in history to ensure that we basically have protection against everything from voter suppression to just basic denial of civil rights. And so again, thank you for inviting me.
You are so welcome. And yes, like you say, what a long history. I'll just add that my own mother marched with Martin Luther King Jr. in 1965 in Selma, leading a group from the NAACP from our area in California. And I know that you are concerned about that particular issue. Can you give us any information about your feelings on that?
Yes, and thank you very much, because voting rights is a big issue that's before us right now, and the Congress of the United States is attempting to deal with it because of the voter suppression efforts that are taking place all over the country. And I think right now we may have 40 states with voter suppression laws. And those laws take the form of everything from reducing early voting days, requiring different kinds of identification, having polling places that are not adequately equipped to take the voters in a timely fashion into the polls. And it goes on and on and on. Mm-hmm. So many ways that voter suppression is taking place. And the NAACP is right here with us. In the Congress of the United States, we have two laws that we're focused on. One is H.R. 1, which anticipated and understands now much of what is being done with voter suppression, and it attempts to make sure that the states are not able to take up these voter suppression laws because they would be in violation of what we do in the Congress of the United States in line with the Constitution. In addition to that, we have the John Lewis voting rights law that is very important because, if you can recall, it was not that long ago that the Supreme Court basically undermined Section 5, I believe it is, the Voting Rights Act. And that was the section that caused certain jurisdictions to have to get permission from the Department of Justice before they could continue with certain actions that may be taken in local jurisdictions. For example, if a law is being advanced in a city that would change the way that votes are done from districts to citywide, which was something that was used historically to keep, you know, those areas that are predominantly minority from having power inside a particular district. And so all of those kinds of things are going on now, and we would try to correct what was done or what was supported in an effort to undo voting rights and the Supreme Court's decision and all of that.
If you are just joining us, this is Dr. Consuelo Mukes speaking with Congresswoman Maxine Waters on The Nonprofit Story.
So the NAACP filed a lawsuit that basically addresses the insurrection that took place on January 6th and the invasion of the Capitol. And so the hearings are taking place right now, and the latest information is that they have requested subpoenas of many of those who were involved with former President Trump in the organizing of that insurrection. So I can't say enough about the importance of the NAACP because we depend on the NAACP working with elected officials in order to have a democracy that respects us all.
The fight just continues, doesn't it? So what? Yes. What would be some ways that we as local NAACP organizations can work better hand in hand with you and other legislators?
Well, I think it's very important, first of all, to give support to the bills that are being advanced in Congress by making sure that your representatives are supportive of the bills that are basically being led by minority caucuses, and to write letters, whether it is tweeting, Facebook, or whether it is doing interviews with radio stations and television stations about voting rights and the attempt to undermine voting rights with suppression laws and why those bills are so important. So sometimes people think, well, you know, I would call my congressperson, but I won't be heard. So many people call, my voice won't get respected. That's not true. We pay a lot of attention to the calls and the letters and the emails that we get from our districts. And so I would advise people to do any or all of that. In addition to that, I would encourage people to join the NAACP. The stronger the NAACP is, the better we're able to fight. And they have a youth group in the NAACP that we've seen some wonderful things come out of.
Thank you for encouraging the youth. We need that so much.
Well, you're absolutely right. Let me just speak a little bit about George Floyd and the murder that took place and what resulted. Many people saw for the first time the way that not only he was killed, but the tactics that were used that are constantly being used in different parts of the country. And the knee on the neck, also the chokehold, and other tactics that are used by abusive officers became an eye-opener. But it also caused many who understood and who have witnessed these kinds of tactics to speak up and act out about it. You saw all of the rallies all over the world. And so it's very important to know that as a result of that, we had legislation that was introduced that identified many of these tactics. And that legislation has literally died in the Senate of the United States of America on police reform. We were trying to create a real database of those kinds of tactics that would have helped us to understand the gravity of these tactics. That was in the legislation. We could not reach an accommodation with the Senate, who refused to negotiate in good faith. And so we have to work hard and continue to work hard to pursue justice in policing and the whole Justice Department. We still have people of color, blacks in particular, that are arrested and jailed in disproportionate numbers, given long sentences, and treated very poorly in the criminal justice system. And so that's an issue that we must continue to pay a lot of attention to.
You know, another area, too, that NAACP also is involved with, and I know that you are, is inclusiveness in the economy and equity as far as economics, housing, income equality. What are some ideas on that?
Well, yes, the NAACP representatives or lobbyists are here on many of the issues that sometimes people don't even realize they're fighting on. The NAACP has always been in support of increasing the minimum wage, for example, which impacts and affects the minority families so very much. In addition to that, I am the chair of the Financial Services Committee and have worked long and hard in dealing with the predatory lending tactics that were so prevalent, which we learned about in 2008, where people of color were encouraged to sign on the bottom line for mortgages, many of which they could not afford, and they were encouraged to take out loans where they paid little or no down payment. And they were encouraged to take out loans where the interest rates would increase in 6 months or a year. And if they could not honor the new payments, they would be foreclosed on. And foreclosures happen in many minority communities across this country. And so the NAACP worked with us as we fought against predatory lending, and we were able to correct many of the predatory practices that banks and financial institutions employ in order to get people in, you know, by suckering them in on these mortgages, and then they ended up getting foreclosed on. And that has been very, very important. In addition to that, I created a subcommittee of my committee on financial services known as Diversity and Inclusion, where we are looking first and mostly at financial services industries, which includes all of Wall Street, all of the banks and financial institutions, looking at the employment practices, whether or not there are upward mobility opportunities for management, whether or not they're involved in contracting fairly with people of color. All of this has to do with our attempts to close the wealth gap in this country. And as you have just mentioned, it is very important for us to understand the historical tactics that have been used to prevent us from being able to develop wealth and to have careers that pay good salaries and with benefits, et cetera, et cetera. And so the NAACP is involved in support of those kinds of issues in my financial services committee, and I'm very appreciative for it.
And I just do want to mention that you have made history by being the first woman and the first African-American chair of the financial services committee.
Thank you very much.
Yes, yes. If you are just joining us, this is Dr. Consuelo Mukes speaking with Congresswoman Maxine Waters on the nonprofit story on Issues and Ideas, KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Another issue that I know we have been working on very much in our area and other NAACPs is on the health and well-being situation dealing with COVID-19. A lot in the Black community and other minority communities are still not vaccinated and still dying in disproportionate rates. And some still fear the vaccine because of history. Some believe the pandemic is over. It's time to ease up on masking, sanitizing. Would you have a message to give us to help us to understand that situation better?
Absolutely. And of course, we should all be concerned that there appears to be some vaccination hesitancy in some of our communities. And we've got to do more to encourage, to get the word out. And I'm thinking about the use of incentives. I've noticed that in some jurisdictions across the country, they've used all kinds of incentives, whether or not they're sports tickets, tickets to sports events. Mm-hmm. Some, there's been some cash incentives, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm looking closely at that as a possibility to use in some of the areas where we do not appear to be getting the people involved in vaccination opportunities. I'm particularly worried about the mandates that are coming down for our school kids. Mm-hmm. And if they're not getting the vaccinations, their parents are not getting them, there's going to be a big educational gap confronting us for the future. And so we've got to do a better job. I am working with some people now where we're thinking and trying to come up with the incentives and to concentrate in public housing developments and in low-income housing units where sometimes the information does not get out as well as it should. And we must serve as examples and make sure that the clinics are easily available and do not have to have reservations, but can walk in off the street and get tested to get vaccinations, and that our churches and our religious institutions be a part of that, where their sites can be used in order to get this work done, and the ministers implore people from the pulpit to make sure that they get their vaccinations, because still, you know, many of the churches are virtual. They're using Zoom. Some of them are coming back where they have in-person attendance, but they must honor social distancing. And so they have incentives by which to tell people that they want them back in church. And back in church means that you've got to be vaccinated. You've got to wear a mask. We've got to honor social distancing, all of that. We got started a little bit slow. The previous president was not very helpful in helping us get the message out. And so we've overcome that with Biden.
As our time is running down, I want you to share with us some remarks then on where do you feel NAACP can continue to walk hand in hand with you to work on some of the most important things you are seeing happen.
Well, I thank you very much for that question, because there are several big issues before the Congress of the United States now. One that is referred to as the infrastructure bill, which is about a $1 trillion bill that is designed to repair our bridges and our roads and our highways and our water systems and all of that. Along with that are contracts. These contracts are handled through city government. We will send the money down from Washington, D.C., to the states and to the local jurisdictions. And so we want more information disseminated about contracting opportunities. We want the NAACP to put this in their platforms so that they can disseminate information so that our contractors can have the information that's necessary to compete for what are very, very good contracts that will be coming down. And I think we're going to be able to pass that infrastructure bill soon as we can get the reconciliation bill passed. Now, reconciliation is vitally important. Mm-hmm. This is legislation that includes all kind of new forward-thinking support for our communities and our families, such as child care, early childhood education, expansion of health care, dealing with climate change. In my committee, my portion has to do with housing, mm-hmm. and I have a $300 billion piece of legislation to deal with everything from number one, monies that has to be put into public housing to do the kind of renovation and repairs and upkeep that needs to be done in public housing. It also has to do with making sure that we have thousands, if not millions, more Section 8 vouchers available to people who need to have their rent subsidized. Mm-hmm. It's very important. Some people have been trying to get Section 8 vouchers for years, and in this portion of the bill that I have over housing, we're going to have more money for vouchers, and we're going to have more money for public housing. Also, we have money in that bill to assist first-generation homeowners with their down payments. Many of our young people in particular who work every day, and they can afford a mortgage, but they can't afford to save up enough money for a down payment to become homeowners. And we have that in this legislation. Also, we have a program that a lot of people are not familiar with that comes to the cities, known as the CDBG program and the home program, all that help with subsidies. So housing is huge, and homelessness is just unconscionable in this country. And so I would like the NAACP just to be at the top of their list of things to pay attention to, and that is getting the support letters in or calling in on the radio stations, using all of our platforms in order to support housing in the reconciliation bill. This is big, and this is one of the areas where we've had discrimination, you know, historically in this country, that have kept people from not only having safe and secure housing, but ownership, but housing ownership. We believe that investment in housing is very important, particularly in California. The equity that you get in purchasing a house can provide resources to open a business, to pay for college for children, et cetera, et cetera. And so the economy and economics, very important subjects for the NAACP and all of its chapters to be involved in.
Congresswoman Waters, it's been a pleasure to speak with you today as the most senior of the 12 Black women in Congress and taking time out to share this with us. We thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome, and thank you for the opportunity to have an interview with your community through you. And please stay in contact, and my staff and I are ready to answer any questions or to give assistance in any way that we can to help you facilitate some of the ideas that you may have that we have touched upon today.
Congresswoman Maxine Waters, she will be the keynote speaker at the Freedom Fund Gala Committed to Social Justice with the NAACP in SLO County on October 16th. We want to thank the Congresswoman for taking the time out of her busy schedule to join us today with this special edition of the Nonprofit Story.
Learn more about the fundraising event at naacpslocty.com. Dangerous Air is a collaborative investigation, and it answers the question, how much wildfire smoke have we been breathing in, and what are the health risks?
I'm Kaylee Wells. Wildfires in California have burned 2 million acres this year. Across the country, more than 5.5 million acres have burned. Our analysis shows a startling increase in the number of days people across the country are breathing dangerous air. The smoke impacts extend from California and the Pacific Northwest to the Rocky Mountains and all the way to the East Coast. And the smoke is making people sick. California hospital records show an additional 30,000 admissions for respiratory and cardiac conditions in 2018, a heavy fire year, compared to just 2 years before. I'm Kaylee Wells.
I'm Farida Javala Romero in Willows. Longtimers say sports events anchor the town of Willows, 100 miles north of Sacramento. At a Friday junior varsity football game in this town of 6,000, cheerleaders shake their gold and purple pom-poms. Thick haze covers nearby mountains in this part of the Sacramento Valley as megafires burn in Northern California. When there's too much smoke in the air, schools cancel outdoor activities like football. But today...
Today's better, obviously, because we're playing the game.
Stacy Lancey has two teen sons, one of them a student at this high school. She's also a third grade teacher and says the bad air quality is affecting students.
As far as like kids going out to recess, playing sports, and kind of like an overall health, we don't know why we're having headaches and runny noses.
Headaches, runny noses, and a myriad of more serious health problems have all been linked to breathing wildfire smoke. Willows endured more than 3 months of smoke per year on average between 2016 and 2020, making it the smokiest place in the state. Millions of Americans are also breathing a lot more smoke from western wildfires, an impact felt from Los Angeles to Washington, D.C. That's according to an analysis of a decade of federal satellite images by NPR's California Newsroom in partnership with Stanford University's Environmental Change and Human Outcomes Lab. In a small town like Willows, physician assistant Brett Brown regularly treats patients at the hospital's family clinic. When there's smoke in the air, he sees more patients suffering asthma attacks, intense migraines, and stress.
There's always somebody who says something about, well, because of the smoke, insert, you know, problem here, whether it's I haven't been able to breathe as well because my allergies are so bad, or I haven't been able to see my mom and dad because of COVID, and now I can't even go outside, so my mental health is so much worse.
Children are more sensitive to dangerous particles and wildfire smoke because their lungs are developing. Since this scale of wildfires has never been seen before in modern history, we don't know much about the long-term impacts. And that has parents like Brown worried.
So if you let your kids play outside during smoke days, what's going to happen to their lung capacity or their cancer risk? We don't know what that data looks like yet.
At Murdoch Elementary, hundreds of students pour out of classrooms and play with balls and hula hoops during recess. It's a good day, but Principal Miguel Barriga doesn't take this recess for granted. When the air quality reaches levels the federal government says are unhealthy, Barriga has to keep students inside all day. And that's tough for some kids.
You know, we'll end up in the office acting out in class, get emotional one way or another, or want to go home.
Like other school administrators here, Barriga monitors local air quality reports constantly during wildfire season. He says he wants better forest management and solutions to climate change so fires don't burn so intensely.
You want to believe that the decisions at levels higher than ours are going to be made, will be made to make it be more normal.
More like it used to be, he says, when you could go outside and not worry about breathing wildfire smoke. I'm Farida Javala Romero in Willows.
Go to kcbx.org for pictures, data, and more stories related to dangerous air. And finally, a look at bees. Bees are responsible for pollinating about one-third of the world's food supply, but the honeybee population has been declining rapidly throughout the last 20 years, according to the United States Environmental Protection Agency. KCBX's Angel Russell reports on a local group working to help the honeybee population.
Okay, so this is my bee yard, or apiary is the professional term for where we keep bees.
Aaron Holden, the president of Central Coast Beekeepers Alliance LO, takes care of more than 20 different honeybee colonies. Her group hopes to encourage people to get into beekeeping, and the group also provides resources for people to remove hives from their homes without killing the bees.
Commercial beekeepers are the ones that are really out there helping pollinate our food sources. So for a backyard beekeeper, you're probably not making a big impact in the food industry world as a pollinator, but it does keep the small person does keep the industry going.
According to a report by the Bee Informed Partnership, commercial beekeepers in California reported a loss of 30% of their colonies in the year 2020. Holden says there are a couple reasons honeybees are struggling. One is the near constant state of drought facing California, with reduced water affecting the plants bees use to collect nectar. Another growing threat, the varroa mite, a pest that is ravaging bee colonies around the world.
The biggest threat to our bees at this point is the varroa mite. It's a little tiny mite that feeds on every life stage of the bee, so anywhere from them being a larva to a pupa to an adult bee.
Holden says the parasites feed off the fat of the bees and slowly weaken them. The mites can also transmit a virus called deformed wing virus,
which can literally cause a bee to be unable to fly and be out foraging for nectar. So the varroa mite is something we have to be on top of as beekeepers.
Another problem in the bee world, people destroying hives that show up on their properties.
If they're way up high in a tree and they're not bothering anybody, I'd say, you know, just leave them alone.
Atascadero beekeeper Michael Lindsay says if a beehive is in an area near your house that is too close for comfort, you can call a company to remove them. But make sure to ask what method they use to get rid of the hive.
they may come and spray a pesticide and it kills the bees, and then bees in the neighborhood, like in a tree somewhere or somewhere else, they'll come and rob out that hive that got sprayed with pesticides, and they'll take that pesticide back to their hive and it'll kill those bees.
There are several companies throughout Slo County who can remove a hive, but Lindsay encourages using one to gas the bees and try to rehome them instead of killing them. Once you've noticed a hive that you want gone around your home, Lindsay says, don't wait too long on addressing it.
Because if they stay in the house a long period of time, they'll build a lot of comb, store a lot of honey, there'll be a lot of bees, and it'll be a much bigger project.
Holden says it's not a good idea to try to take care of removing a hive without professional help, especially since some beehives can be Africanized honeybees, also known as killer bees.
They're very aggressive, so you'll have a lot of bees coming at you to sting you very aggressively. They chase you longer if you're trying to get away from them. They're very much more persistent. They'll travel farther to attack you.
Holden says while honeybees sting to defend, killer bees mobilize as an entire colony if their hive is attacked. But Holden says while their temperament has earned them a bad reputation, Africanized honeybees do serve a useful function as they also pollinate plants. If a bee comes into your car or buzzes around you out in public, Holden says stay calm and just wait until the bee flies away.
Is it okay to kill any bug? Right? They all have a purpose.
If you are stung, get the stinger out as soon as you can. Lindsay says using something with a sharp edge, like a credit card, to scrape out the stinger should do the trick.
The stinger on the honeybee, it's barbed like a fish hook. So when the stinger goes in, it's got this little barb that keeps it in, and the bee pulls away and it leaves that stinger in you with a little venom sac, and that venom sac pumps and keeps pumping venom into you.
Lindsay says despite the unwanted stings or hives popping up in the wrong places around your home, it reminds people that honeybees are the world's smallest agricultural workers, pollinating 80% of U.S. grown crops. Saving the bees, Lindsay says, means saving the food that we get to enjoy. For KCBX News, I'm Andrew Russell.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.